Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, President Obama faces tough questions on Malaysia rights. South Korea's prime minister offers resignation over ferry disaster. In Thailand, poet's daytime shooting death raises worries of rising tensions. These stories and more in this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. President Barack Obama is winding down a visit to Malaysia, where he faced tough questions Sunday on political freedoms in the country. Next, the president heads to the Philippines, where the United States confirms it will sign an agreement to rotate U.S. troops to Philippine military bases. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with the president.
After a lavish welcome on Saturday, President Obama on Sunday toured Malaysia's large national mosque, which sits on more than 5 hectares and holds up to 15,000 people. The mosque visit was a gesture of goodwill toward Malaysia's predominantly Muslim population. Mr. Obama sought to portray the country as a model of democracy and a model for coexistence between a Muslim majority and the sizable minorities of Buddhists, Christians, and Hindus. Not at the forefront of the president's visit were discussions on what critics say are the Malaysian government attempts to clamp down on press freedom and quash the opposition. Mr. Obama's schedule did not include a meeting with opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. The government has for years been pursuing sodomy charges against Anwar in what his supporters say is an illegitimate attempt to keep him from running for office. At a joint briefing with Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Tun Razak, Mr. Obama was asked why he did not meet with Anwar.
The fact that I haven't met with Mr. Anwar in and of itself is not indicative of our lack of concern, given the fact that there are a lot of people I don't meet with and opposition leaders that I don't meet with, and that doesn't mean that I'm not concerned about them.
The U.S. president said he did raise the issue of civil liberties with Prime Minister Najib.
What I have shared with the Prime Minister is the core belief that societies that respect rule of law, that respect freedom of speech, that respect the right of opposition to oppose, even when it drives you crazy, even when it's inconvenient, the respect for freedom of assembly, the respect for people of different races and different faiths and different political philosophies, that those values are at the core of who the U.S. is, but also, I think, are a pretty good gauge of whether a society is going to be successful in the 21st century or not.
On the missing Malaysia Airlines flight, Mr. Obama said the U.S. remains absolutely committed to providing whatever resources it can to facilitate the search. Lyndon Johnson was the last U.S. president to travel to Malaysia in 1966 during the Vietnam War, when the United States was working to maintain support among its Southeast Asian allies against the spread of communism. Now, Mr. Obama has a different challenge in the region, the threat of China's expanding military and primarily its growing assertiveness in the East and South China Seas, where it has competing territorial claims with a number of countries. Those claims and the threats they pose to regional security are the main theme in the Philippines, his fourth stop on this Asian tour. The Philippines and China are locked in a dispute over islands in the South China Sea. The major item on the president's agenda in Manila is an agreement on enhanced defense cooperation to rotate U.S. troops into the country and station them temporarily on Philippine military bases. It would allow for the largest U.S. military presence in the country since the Philippines ended the leases on U.S. bases more than 2 decades ago. The agreement says U.S. troops can come only by invitation of the Philippine government, but critics say the deal violates Philippine sovereignty and have staged demonstrations ahead of Mr. Obama's arrival. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Kuala Lumpur.
Coming up on Daybreak Asia, Afghan elections are headed for a runoff. South Korea's prime minister has offered his resignation over a passenger ferry disaster earlier this month that left over 300 dead and missing. President Park Geun-hye says she will accept the resignation from the mainly ceremonial post, but only after all the bodies of the victims are recovered. VOA's Daniel Sharif reports from Seoul.
Prime Minister Chung Hong Wan Sunday held himself responsible for the government's handling of the ferry tragedy. At a televised press conference in Seoul, he offered to step down. He says he would like to offer an apology to the people as a representative of their government. He says the government could not solve many problems that occurred in the process of preventing the incident, the initial response, and in controls afterwards. The five-story ship, the Sewol, capsized on April 16th southwest of mainland South Korea with 476 people on board and quickly sank. Most were teenagers on a trip organized by their high school just south of Seoul to the resort island of Jeju. Authorities were severely criticized for what many saw as a slow and poorly coordinated initial response to the disaster. Inaccurate information on the numbers of rescued, passengers, and missing made matters worse for already distraught parents. Education authorities initially indicated most of those on board the sinking ship were rescued before corrections revealed the scale of the loss. Hundreds of rescue divers were deployed but were hampered by weather, strong currents, and poor visibility. Relatives of those on board, hoping for survivors, watched helplessly as it took days to get divers inside the sunken ship. Bodies were still slowly being recovered more than a week later as bad weather continued to plague recovery efforts. Prime Minister Chung, along with the Coast Guard chief, was in charge of the rescue operation. He says his resignation would be a sensible way to offer the people of South Korea an apology. He says he should be responsible as a prime minister. He saw the pain of the families of victims who writhed in agony from losing their loved ones and the sorrow and anger of their people. During separate visits to a gymnasium on Jindo Island housing the relatives, angry parents pounced on the prime minister and heckled the president. Opposition politicians criticized the prime minister's offer to resign as irresponsible and demanded President Park be the one to apologize. But most of South Korea's outrage is directed at the captain and crew in charge of steering the ship. They have been arrested and charged with negligence and violating maritime law for telling passengers to stay put and then later saving themselves. It is still not clear what caused the ferry to sink. Investigators are looking into many possibilities, including an alleged sharp turn, design or repair flaws, or overweight cargo. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Seoul.
Each week, you may take part in our poll question at voanews.com/daybreakasia and on our VOA Asia Facebook page. This past week, we asked, what do you think caused the South Korean ferry boat Sewol to sink? The majority of our audience responding, more than 56%, said it was caused by mistakes made by the captain and or the crew. About 16% felt damage from an external source, such as a large underwater debris or strong current, was to blame, while almost 10% thought it was mechanical issues with the ship. Almost 18% were not sure, with some in our audience telling me that it should have been all of the above. Well, regardless, we thank you for your thoughts and comments as the investigation continues. You can stop by our program page for more at voanews.com/daybreakasia. Speaking of voting, it appears that no candidate won a majority in Afghanistan's April 5th election, so there will probably be a second round runoff vote between Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani. The runoff should be held within 15 days of final results, which are due May 14th. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
The Afghan Independent Election Commission says former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah won nearly 45% of the overall vote, and Ashraf Ghani, a former finance minister, received 32%. The head of the commission, Ahmed Yusuf Nuristani, says election officials counted nearly 7 million ballots. He says that once fraud investigations are finished and findings are shared with the commission, the results will be finalized on May 14th. Nuristani insists that the commission will have enough time to cope with logistics and security issues for the vote.
I think the election went pretty good. We are satisfied with it, with the result. I think we are prepared if it goes to second round. Yes, we think it's doable, and we have a tentative schedule to start the second round.
The election winner will replace President Hamid Karzai, who has been leading Afghanistan since late 2001. Constitutional limits keep him from running again. Relations between President Karzai and the Obama administration are strained because Mr. Karzai refuses to sign a bilateral security agreement that would allow a small force of American soldiers to remain in Afghanistan after 2014 to continue training Afghan forces to fight the Taliban. Both Abdullah and Ghani have promised a fresh start with the United States and vowed to conclude the security deal. The U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, James Dobbins, sounded optimistic about the future of the pact after the political transition in Kabul.
We're disappointed that it hasn't been signed already. In the recent election campaign, all of the candidates endorsed it, and all of the leading candidates have made clear that they intend to sign it shortly after assuming office. So I think we're quite confident that it is likely to be concluded.
The American diplomat said the United States is not considering a total pullout of its troops from Afghanistan.
The zero option isn't an option for us. It's an option for Afghanistan. If they don't want us, we won't stay. We're certainly not going to force ourselves. However, we are encouraged that the Afghan people, the Afghan political class, and the Afghan presidential candidates have all endorsed a continued American and a continued international role. I think the international community is going to remain committed, will remain present at much lower levels, I think is the likely outcome. And I think the prospects for continued development for Afghanistan are quite good.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has welcomed the preliminary election results, calling the process more transparent than ever before. UN officials have urged the Election Commission and the Independent Electoral Complaints Commission to ensure that credible complaints are properly handled and that the integrity of the electoral process is safeguarded. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The shooting death of a prominent pro-government poet in Thailand is prompting concerns it could lead to more political violence in the country. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
The daylight shooting of 45-year-old Kamol Dongphasuk outside a restaurant in the capital is the latest unsolved attack on a high-profile figure in Thailand at a time of political instability. Kamol, better known by his pen name, Mainong Korkonti, was a supporter of the Red Shirt Movement, which backs the government of interim Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, who has been battling to stay in office. Kamol was killed in his car in the parking lot of a restaurant Wednesday afternoon. A leader of the United Front for Democracy, the core Red Shirt group, Dr. Weng Tojurakarn, says it is obvious from the crime scene and the two wounds on the victim's chest that the activist artist was assassinated at close range.
I think that the bullet come from the pistol not very far from my name. So the assassin must be very close, maybe not more than 1 meter.
Kamol had spoken out against Thailand's harsh Less Majest law, under which those convicted can face up to 15 years in prison for defamation of the royal family. The Red Shirts are often labeled as being against the country's monarchy, something their leaders deny. A retired Army Major General, an anti-government figure who runs a private hospital in Bangkok, recently set up what he calls the Rubbish Collection Organization to flush out those allegedly insulting the monarchy. Dr. Weng says he sees no coincidence between the establishment of the new group and the latest killing. He calls for its founder, Dr. Rintong Nana, to denounce the lethal attack. Dr. Rintong declined a VOA request for an interview. UDD leader Weng says the Red Shirts, despite their anger at being targeted, will not retaliate.
We resolutely stand on the nonviolent method. So even we do know that mining has been killed by the political conflict, we still tell our colleague that please don't use the violent method because we can't overcome or solve the political conflict by the violent method.
The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch non-governmental organization is calling for Thai authorities to investigate the killing and bring whoever is responsible to justice, wherever that investigation leads. The group's statement also notes the recent formation of the pro-monarchy organization, which calls those accused of committing Les Majest offenses garbage and vows to exterminate them. Human Rights Watch says Kamol's death can only worsen the already tense political situation in Thailand. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Hong Kong's government is days away from completing a process of inviting public ideas about how the autonomous Chinese territory should elect its next leader in 2017, the first time that post will be filled by universal suffrage. The city has long been divided. A pan-democratic coalition of parties wants members of the public to be able to nominate anyone to become a candidate for the chief executive post. A pro-government and pro-Beijing coalition says candidates should only be nominated by a committee in strict accordance with Hong Kong's constitution or basic law. Pro-democracy activists fear a committee consisting of mainly pro-government members will screen out any candidate deemed insufficiently loyal to Beijing. Two veteran pro-democracy activists and former lawmakers, Anson Chan and Martin Lee, visited Washington earlier this month to express those concerns to members of Congress and the Obama administration. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin sat down with Chan at the National Endowment for Democracy and asked her what she thinks of Beijing's role in the dispute about electoral reforms.
Well, I have to say that the signs at the moment are not promising, because it seems to us in Hong Kong that Beijing is attempting to rewrite the basic law. The basic law, actually, which is our constitution, makes it quite clear what is meant by universal suffrage, which is there has to be fair and equal vote for all eligible voters in Hong Kong. But at the same time, I think Beijing does want to listen to the community voice. I don't think their minds are made up as yet. So it's very much up to this government, our government, and to the people of Hong Kong to let Beijing know what is the bottom line. And the bottom line is we want a credible set of proposals that gives voters a genuine choice, that does not set down unreasonable restrictions to prevent people from standing for election, and rules which do not rule out people of different political affiliations.
On the topic of rules, both you and Martin Lee have talked about your emphasis on not having unreasonable restrictions on people who can run. But the Hong Kong government has been trying to say, you know, we're in the process of formulating our guidelines. We haven't set any rules yet. So why should you be concerned now that there are restrictions when the government might say, well, we haven't declared any rules or restrictions yet?
Well, so the government may not have declared its stance, but we've had a number of Beijing officials visiting, delivering views which they seem to want to impress the people of Hong Kong as being the law. It is not the law. And it is quite clear from their rhetoric that they are looking for an election where the outcome can be guaranteed 100%. Well, that is not, in our view, a genuine election.
How concerned are you that there could be another split in the pan-democratic camp when it comes to agreeing on a democracy path that the Hong Kong government and Beijing will ultimately accept? Do you think it's a strong risk right now that there will be another fracturing like we've seen in the past in how the pan-democratic camp approaches these issues?
Well, my own view at the moment is that the pan-democratic camp, the political parties involved, are much more united this time around. I think they see strength in the final analysis in coming up with a set of proposals which are credible and which most political parties in the pan-democratic camp can sign their name to. And this is what we're all working towards.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also been a bit of a generational shift with, in the last election, a kind of a younger generation of Democrats being elected to office. And some of them seem to express, you know, tougher, maybe less compromising views on universal suffrage. So we also have a lot of young members of the democracy movement in Hong Kong planning to occupy the Central District later this year. So how concerned are you that perhaps the Democratic camp is moving in a position of having a tougher line on the issues, not being ready to compromise so much, and with the Occupy Central movement, perhaps even creating a backlash and alienating members of the community?
Well, the Occupy Central proposal is a reflection of the depth of frustration and disillusionment at this constant foot-dragging on the part of the Hong Kong government and Beijing in delivering on its promise. We've waited a long, long time. It's now 17 years since the handover, and it's high time that we actually see universal suffrage in genuine open elections. The government can very easily avert Occupy Central simply by doing what it should be doing, which is come out with a credible set of proposals, forge a community consensus, and secure the necessary approval in the legislature.
So I'll ask you also about your efforts here in the U.S. Why are you in New York and Washington on this visit? What do you hope to get out of your meetings with officials here with Americans? And how concerned are you that your critics back in Hong Kong will say, oh, Martin Lee and Addison Chan are just trying to drum up foreign interference in our affairs?
We're prepared for that criticism. But the United States government has always been a staunch supporter of democracy for Hong Kong. They've supported Hong Kong, and they've supported the Joint Declaration. And I think they would pay attention to whether, 17 years after the handover, Beijing is going to honor its promises to the people of Hong Kong. We're here to tell the American people, to tell the United States government what is actually happening in Hong Kong, to point to some of the areas of concern that impinges on our core values. And these core values are of interest to our trading partners because we share these core values with the United States and with many other countries. And if we can no longer maintain these core values, then business prospects at the end of the day will be adversely affected.
Former Hong Kong lawmaker and pro-democracy activist Addison Chan speaking with Michael Lippin. Tomorrow on Daybreak Asia, we'll bring you Michael's interview with pro-government Hong Kong lawmaker Regina Ip, who criticizes Chan for lobbying U.S. officials. China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook, VOA Asia. Well, Alexander Levy was of interest in China just a short time ago because he's the new Volvo China Open champion after a four-shot victory at the Genzin Golf Club in Shenzhen. The French golfer won by a four-shot margin, as Mark Tompkins reports from Shenzhen.
Levy had come into the tournament ranked 282nd in the world and had never won on the European Tour, but he played superbly on Friday with a 10-under par 62 and never looked back. A final round 69 closed out his maiden title, and he even finished with two birdies, having just missed an eagle putt on 17.
I'm happy to play well today because shoot 3-under today was not easy, and no, I'm very happy with this tournament. I like the pressure. I practice for the pressure, and I was in confidence on the free iron shot, and I make one of the best shots of the week, I think, because with the pressure was a pretty tough shot, yeah.
He was pressed all the way, though, by young Englishman Tommy Fleetwood. At one point, Fleetwood was just a shot behind the leader and finished with a final round 68 and second place.
Just didn't drive it well on the back nine. My strength all week has been my driving, and I didn't hit it in play enough. Got away with it a couple of times, but it's been a fantastic week.
Alvaro Quiroz, who had been the nearest challenger to the leader overnight, struggled to get going and finished third despite a round of level par.
Obviously, the positive thing about it is the last time that I was in contention was Portugal Masters, but before that was almost 2 years. So I'm happy to be where I am, and I'm expecting now, I have to recognise that I'm expecting a lot now, the Spanish Open.
Francesco Molinari also fared well on the final day with a 67 to come in fourth. Anders Hansen shot the low round of the day with a 63 to lift him into a tie for fifth, alongside Henrik Stenson, who enjoyed his best round of the week, and Ian Poulter, who finished off with a second successive round of 67. A word too for Danny Willett, who won a new car for a hole-in-one on the 12th. No one could touch Levy, though, who's a worthy champion, and was sprayed with champagne by his French colleagues at the conclusion. It'll dramatically improve his ranking, and he writes his name into the history books as the winner of the 20th edition of the Volvo China Open. Mark Tompkins, Shenzhen.
At the top of our leaderboard for the latest world news is Steve Norman. He's next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.